Hello and welcome to the interview with Owen Bennett-Jones. And my guest today, a man who's one of America's experts on Al-Qaeda. He's worked as an intelligence officer in Afghanistan and Iraq and now runs the Counter-Terrorism Center at the U.S. Military Academy. It's called West Point, a very famous institution in New York. We're there now, and Major Reed Sawyer is here. So thanks very much for talking to us on the interview.
Thank you.
And is Al-Qaeda winning?
I think on balance that we would have to agree that Al-Qaeda is winning today. And this is as much from their own efforts as it is from the challenges that we face in counterterrorism strategy and operations around the world. But there's little doubt today that Al-Qaeda is stronger than they were in 2001 on a variety of different fronts.
And yet there have been no big attacks, actually, on America or on Europe since that one in London.
This is the vexing part about this, and it all depends on how we define winning. I think that from my perspective, that is certainly a positive that Al-Qaeda hasn't had a major attack since 9/11 in America or since the 7/7 attacks in London and the other failed plots in the United Kingdom. But nonetheless, I think that their fundraising ability has increased over time, that their message is resonating in different corners of the world and to degrees that it hasn't before. The support that they're reaching from the jihadist diaspora is certainly exceptionally strong. And so I think that on these many fronts, while they haven't had the single metric of a successful attack, they're still a stronger organization.
Well, it's a very striking statement. And so let's sort of try and work out why you think that. And I'll start, if I can, with the military battle that's going on. And there are a number of theaters of this battle, and you've fought in some of them and served in some of them. And foremost, I guess, in people's minds is Iraq. Now, I think it's generally felt that Al-Qaeda is doing badly in Iraq. Would you agree with that?
I would. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI, as we refer to it commonly here, certainly has withstood a lot of losses. We have fractured their network because we've been able to sustain pressure across the breadth of the network itself to the point that we are able to diminish their ability to operate. We constrain their operating environment, and today they're no longer the force that they were.
Okay, well, if you're right and there has been the success, it's worth knowing how you've done it. And the answer is you've worked with local Sunni leaders and paid them and negotiated with them and dealt with them, and they are they're fighting for you.
Part of it, no doubt, is the fact that the local Sunni tribes have turned, that were once fighting alongside Al-Qaeda in Iraq, have now turned against Al-Qaeda. That certainly makes for a much more hostile environment. It's much harder for Al-Qaeda in Iraq to exist in this type of environment. I think that the large-scale success though that we're seeing in Iraq is from our special operations forces that are able to conduct very, very precise operations, if you will, but continually across the spectrum of the battlefield, and we just have applied that pressure consistently to the point that they can no longer operate as a large structured network that they once had.
Okay, so that's your assessment of Iraq. Let me ask you about Saudi Arabia, where, of course, most of the people who attacked the United States on 9/11 came from. How is the battle going in Saudi Arabia?
This is an interesting question. There's no doubt that the Saudi government has had large degrees of success against the cells that have emerged within Saudi Arabia, and that they have arrested hundreds of individuals, if not thousands, in the pursuit of shutting down the Al-Qaeda support structures within Saudi Arabia. But I don't think that there's any doubt that there's still a large degree of ideological support and ideological guidance that's emanating from Saudi Arabia, as well as an undetermined amount of financial support that is no different across many of these countries that is emanating from private citizens and the like, essentially Al-Qaeda's fundraising arm that is perpetuating.
We'll talk about the money a little later on as a separate sort of issue, but just in terms of the society there, isn't it the case that actually more and more Al-Qaeda people are being turned in by normal Saudi citizens who see them increasingly as troublemakers and not as heroes?
I can't comment on the specifics of it just because I don't have that knowledge, but I think that is a pattern that we're seeing writ large. I mean, Al-Qaeda is fundamentally, at the ideological level, incompatible with most of these societies, even a society such as Saudi Arabia.
All right, so your assessment would be that the campaign against Al-Qaeda in Iraq has gone well, and in Saudi it's going pretty well. Where is it going badly?
I think that it's going badly in the areas that are outside of the declared combat zones, outside of Iraq or Afghanistan or necessarily parts of the Horn of Africa, where Al-Qaeda itself has been, for a variety of reasons, but has been allowed to reconstitute itself. For instance, we've seen a reemergence of Al-Qaeda in Yemen in the past several years, and the cells reemerged there, where the government of Yemen struggles with the ability to both take care of their internal security threats from rebellions or other dissents, tribal issues within the country, as well as dealing with complicated set of factors from the Al-Qaeda threat. And while Yemen is certainly a far-out place, it demonstrates the interest that Al-Qaeda has in maintaining an organizational presence in areas that are beyond what we might consider as the periphery, but what Al-Qaeda senior leaders consider as the Arab core states.
Okay, and in that category as well, maybe North Africa?
Absolutely. This is where I think that Al-Qaeda has had the most success, has been in the alignment with formerly known as the GSPC in Algeria, which now is Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, or AQIM. The merger of these two organizations, or the alignment of these two organizations, has been a windfall, really, for both sides of those fights, and has presented Al-Qaeda with some really unique capabilities that they lacked before. The fact that individuals today now can attend a training camp in North Africa run by Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, that the training camp may be in Algeria or Morocco or other locations that is being run by this organization, but then the individuals are still getting to touch Al-Qaeda. They don't have to travel to Waziristan to participate in a training camp. If you're in North Africa, all you have to do, the distance, the transaction cost, if you will, is much lower.
Yeah, but actually there's no evidence, is there, that those Al-Qaeda activities in North Africa and Yemen are affecting the United States. And it just occurs to me that if, in those theatres, the US doesn't go and fight, there's much less of a problem. I mean, the problem really arises when you do go and fight.
I don't know that I would agree with that necessarily. I certainly think that where there is U.S. presence, we present a target of opportunity for Al-Qaeda and the jihadist organizations, no doubt, as in Iraq. We present a wonderful opportunity for Al-Qaeda to engage our forces. Whereas if we weren't in Iraq, perhaps the target, it would be harder for them to get to.
And are you nervous of an attack on American soil originating from these places you're talking about?
I am not as worried about an attack originating per se from Algeria, certainly not from Yemen. What I am worried about is the skill set, the technical skills that the fighters are getting in these locations, especially inside of Iraq.
Just finally on this question of the military struggle, the sort of hard, military struggle, you haven't mentioned Pakistan. What is your analysis of where that stands?
The Pakistan is really, to me, is and I think to many, is the center. This is the ability for Al-Qaeda senior leadership to enjoy near sanctuary is what gave the Al-Qaeda network the room to breathe. It allowed the leaders to reorganize from purely being an ideological inspiration in 2001, 2002, to now a much more active role that we see with Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri. There are proxy measures for this. We see their public communications and their public statements have increased multiple fold over the past 2 or 3 years in direct appeals to both donors and fighters and sympathizers that are coming from this region. This seems to indicate to us the ability to not only communicate openly with the world, but also really gives a pretty strong indication, I think, of their ability to communicate with the rest of their network and reassert control over the extended network and pull the Al-Qaeda organization back together.
If you're right about that, then there is as good a case for invading northwest Pakistan as there was Afghanistan, and a better case than there was for Iraq.
This is a tough question to answer for a couple reasons. The first is, I think that you have other considerations at play. Certainly any overt military action without the direct cooperation of the Pakistani government would present a huge risk to the government of Pakistan, and I think that we can't risk destabilizing that part of the world simply too. I think that the question is, and what this makes the case for, is not necessarily justification for invasion, but means for justification of figuring out other ways to constrain their ability to operate, not so much a justification for invasion.
Okay, let me ask you about another aspect of the struggle against Al-Qaeda, which you've mentioned already, finance. Now, right after 9/11, you'll remember, I'm sure, President Bush made a big play of this. It was one of the first things he said, the financial war on terror, I'm going to do it at the stroke of a pen, I can weaken the enemy, and so on. How do you think that's gone?
It's clearly in the days after 9/11, we had some major successes, and I think that we're still having successes. We have no doubt made it harder through not only the U.S. actions, but actions with our European partners, made it harder for al-Qaeda to operate in the global financial market, to move financial controls on accounts and these types of measures. Moreover, that al-Qaeda has always had the model, as well as a top-down financing model that they've had, where the senior leadership funds these other operations. But they've always had the model of local bottom-up fundraising as well. And so when you resort to criminal activities to raise money for your organization, now, again, you have an observability problem. Can your law enforcement activities discern some sort of financial crime that is just purely a financial crime or a financial crime where it is leaning towards al-Qaeda support?
But it wasn't just crime, was it? I mean, when al-Qaeda was at its height in Iraq, suicide bombers were coming from Saudi and elsewhere with money, donations, you know, their life savings. So that's not even a criminal matter.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the third prong, right? So you have the regular financing that the organization, what was in their coffers. You have the self-financing by the lower cells that don't receive the money, as well as the financing of individuals that bring the money with them. So suicide bombers bring anywhere from as little as a dollar to thousands of dollars with them into Iraq to donate to the al-Qaeda cause. But then the other development, the donor piece of this, is even more significant, that some of the captured documents indicate that there is large amounts of money being donated by wealthy individuals throughout the Gulf region that are supportive of al-Qaeda's cause.
Right. I should just say, when you say captured documents, as I said, we're sitting in West Point, and you here study a lot of the documents that have been captured by the U.S. military, documents which al-Qaeda have, you know, part of their bureaucracy, if you like. And tell us more about that. What sort of people are giving these sums, and how big are the sums?
Interestingly enough, we don't have really good insight from the declassified documents, which is what we work with here at West Point. But we do know that the numbers are upwards in the tens of millions of dollars that al-Qaeda in Iraq and other elements of al-Qaeda has been able to raise through development activities.
Tens of millions?
Yes. The problem with al-Qaeda, Russ, though, is that they don't have a robust distribution network to be able to move the money across the network. So you will find some parts of al-Qaeda, we saw this in Iraq, where some parts of al-Qaeda were resource-rich. They have plenty of more money than they almost knew what to do with, and other cells that were resource-poor.
Because when they move it now, with all the attention there is on the banks and electronic transfers and so on, they basically have to move it in cash or gold, is that right?
Cash or commodities are correct.
And do you ever pick that up?
When you can. But again, it's an observability question. So with the number of commodity trades that you see in the world, the billions of dollars on a daily basis, it's very hard to discern those types of activities. It's a signal-to-noise problem. How do you find that signal amongst all the noise that's out there on this issue? So the answer is yes, we pick it up, but how much we're picking up in relation to the total number, nobody can answer that, right?
You're listening to the interview on the World Service of the BBC with Owen Bennett-Jones, and my guest today, one of America's leading experts on al-Qaeda, Major Reid Sawyer. Now, I know you can't talk in any detail about the work you've done in Afghanistan and in Iraq, but you have served in those places, and maybe just in general terms, you can tell us what insights has America gained into the nature of al-Qaeda and the kind of people who join it. What can you tell us about that?
We learned some very important lessons that I think it is important that we continually remind ourselves of on a daily basis. The first is that we've learned that it is not a homogenous threat, that al-Qaeda, the members of al-Qaeda, are as varied as the nations that we find represented. It is a mini United Nations, if I can use that metaphor. And I think that that's important for us to remember when we're looking for signals of what al-Qaeda might be doing tomorrow. That the profile of the individuals ranges from very, very well-educated doctors in the United Kingdom to poor individuals traveling from Yemen that want to participate as a foreign fighter in Iraq or as a suicide bomber in, you know, traveling through Pakistan and into Afghanistan. And so to say there is a single profile would, I think, be irresponsible. But I think that that is important and incumbent on us as intelligence specialists, as people looking at counterterrorism, to remind ourselves that it is not a homogenous enemy, that there are as many divisions within al-Qaeda and oppositions as there are types of people.
We could say divisions, but that's I guess, a negative way of looking at it. I mean, you could, from al-Qaeda's point of view, you could say, look, it's one of our strengths that we can draw support from so many different segments of society.
Absolutely. The diversity within the organization is something that not only al-Qaeda recognizes as a strength, but it's something that al-Qaeda is actively recruiting to try and achieve diversity within their ranks. So the more Caucasians that they can get, the more Westerners that they have with passports from host nations like Germany or France or the United Kingdom or other places, the more benefit they are to the organization. And we've seen this time in and time out with al-Qaeda. It is absolutely a positive factor for the organization.
Have you ever tried to put yourself in your enemy's shoes to this extent, that if you thought you were a young man in the tribal areas of Pakistan, young guy trying to make a living on a patch of dust in Afghanistan, a young Palestinian maybe, unable to get himself educated, have you ever thought, if I were in their shoes, I might do the same thing?
I understand the issue. And yes, I have. I have thought about that, because I think that it is important, not necessarily that we have empathy for what they do or that we excuse the actions of political violence. But I think if you don't understand where they're coming from, then there is no hope. There is no possibility of designing an efficacious policy or strategy in which to combat it. I am less worried about the poor person in Waziristan or the unemployed youth in the Palestinian territories, as I am worried about the doctor in the United Kingdom that does not have a glass ceiling, that has achieved their goals, that takes up the cause and of the al-Qaeda's cause or the global jihadist cause. Those are the people that worry me more, because the other people are looking at this, and al-Qaeda, we know this from what the documents that we have, that most of the people that are fighting, that are these the individuals as you described it, they're fighting because they see it as a war of occupation.
You basically find it more difficult to understand them than the Waziri farmer.
I don't know that I find it. I think that it is certainly a struggle that, in my mind, in my personal mind, and something that we work with our cadets here, is understanding how does an individual, perhaps, that is living in the West or that is prosperous living in the Middle East, subordinate all their other life's goals, their ambitions or prosperity, for something where they're willing to give their lives to go fight, where they're willing to put aside their medical practice and drive their truck into the Glasgow airport, right? Those are the questions that I think are hard for us to grapple with.
Now, you've thought about this, you've studied it, and you've reached this sort of attempt to understand your enemy. When you try and present that to the people who employ you, basically the American military and the American politicians, is that a difficult process? Do they want to hear it?
You know, I don't think that there's any doubt that, and I don't mean to be gratuitous in this answer. I believe this that what I'm saying is widely held amongst our intelligence analysts and amongst our intelligence community, that we understand the nuanced level of this problem.
You do understand it widely.
We do.
Yeah,
but that is different from saying that we are able to form effective policy based on that understanding. It is hard. It is difficult to then come up with a way to address, as many have called it in the past 4 or 5 years, the root causes of terrorism, to find an effective way to attack those or to answer the war of ideas. So understanding the problem is one thing, but then translating that understanding into policy is something different.
Right, because it means changing policy.
It is not only changing policy, but it's then creating a viable policy. So even if you want to change, can you actually affect change at these different levels?
We've talked about America's difficulties in changing its policy and getting its message across. And I think you'd agree, in many parts of the Middle East, it's gone quite badly.
Yes.
But al-Qaeda's has too, would you think?
Absolutely.
So tell us about that, because it is almost like both sides are losing the propaganda war.
Well, I agree with that. I think that when you're talking about the war of ideas or the propaganda war, there is no doubt that it is harder today at this point with the Iraqi situation as it is for the U.S. to have a message that is appealing to would-be sympathizers or supporters of al-Qaeda. I think that we are at a decided disadvantage to create a powerful narrative in which to dissuade people from supporting al-Qaeda. I think where al-Qaeda's propaganda becomes very hard to answer and that we do not do well on is countering the Muslim-on-Muslim violence, right? Understanding that al-Qaeda has been responsible for thousands of Muslims' deaths inside of Iraq, that in and of itself is something that we should be leveraging in a better way, that we all should be leveraging in a better way, to answer al-Qaeda's narrative about how they're the true answer, right? It is hard to sell that if they're out there slaughtering other Muslims.
So you're talking about al-Qaeda's civilian casualties, of which there are many, and it is causing them a problem.
It is, and we know that they're sensitive to this. We know that within the al-Qaeda organization in Algeria, that they're sensitive to the targets that they picked because they came under great scrutiny under the media forums, their chat rooms, for the suicide bombings of last December in which they killed and injured many, many Muslim citizens.
But the scale of America's failure on the propaganda front is remarkable. I mean, you haven't convinced even Europe. I mean, I was talking to a senior EU official who was saying, I don't believe in the war on terror. It's all on the record. Don't believe in the war on terror. It's a criminal matter. It's a war of ideas. It's a political issue. America's campaign is counterproductive. You know, he's utterly unconvinced. Senior European Union official.
You know, I don't necessarily disagree. I don't necessarily take issue with those statements. It is not a war on terror. It is fundamentally a war against al-Qaeda. Really, what we're facing is sort of a three-front conflict, if you will. The first is best characterized as a war of actions. This is where we and they being al-Qaeda, are locked in a battle that takes place in hours, minutes, and days. Right? These are the IED bombs or the 721 failed attacks on our transportation networks or the Madrid bombings and our counterstrikes against those networks. You have the second war or actions that are taking place as the war of networks, that at the end of the day, success will come from being able to either they're leveraging their networks and being successful at establishing them or our ability to disassemble those networks. That type of effort takes months and years. The third kind of action becomes this battle of ideas, this counter-narrative that is taking place where we're both trying to sell the world on the alternative visions. At the end of the day, what's important isn't that the potential sympathizers of al-Qaeda, like the United States or like the European Union's view of the world. What's important at the end of the day is that they don't prefer al-Qaeda's vision of what the world ought to be.
Yeah, but it is remarkable, this, because when you think that, I mean, I was speaking to al-Qaeda supporters who say they want to kill everyone who's not a Muslim. Now, that's quite a difficult argument to get across to most Muslims as being a reasonable position to take.
Absolutely.
And yet, it seems difficult to counter it. I mean, how difficult can it be to counter that?
Well, there's two pieces to that, right? So part of it is that you have to have the legitimacy in which to counter that argument. And ultimately, I think that because of foreign policy actions and perceived actions that the West, and I don't mean just the United States, but that we all sort of lack the legitimacy in which to counter that kind of argument. And I think that it is our roles as part of our strategy is incumbent on us to enable others who have that legitimacy and standing within the organizations to make that argument.
It's interesting listening to you. I mean, I get the impression that you basically think the United States would be in a much stronger position if it did less of this, you know, military occupation.
The war on terror, and I don't like that term. I think it has come to become a useful shorthand to describe the struggle that we're faced with. Is at the end of the day, fundamentally not military action. At the end of the day, fundamentally will not win the battle. It is a necessary component that when there's a terrorist cell in Madrid or Germany, the IJU cell that was in Germany or in France or the United States, that military and law enforcement action are used to disassemble that cell. That is a necessary component. But military action is not sufficient to win. It takes diplomacy. It takes economics. It takes a different way to approach the problem.
Would it be right for me to say that whereas an increasing number of American generals see it that way, it hasn't yet convinced the politicians?
No, I think that it has. I would disagree. I think that the politicians are convinced of it. I think then becomes the delta that we have to close. The difference that we have to close then becomes how do you okay? So if it's not the military solution, then what solution is it? And then how do you gauge whether these types of programs are successful? What are your metrics for your international development program, your microfinance programs in Waziristan? How do you know that they're being successful? And when you can't touch or feel that, it becomes very ephemeral. And ephemeral foreign policy is something that I think that none of our politicians are comfortable with.
Major Itoi, thanks very much for talking to us on the interview.